This is Kids These Days.
This week on the program, we're talking about technology today and the way it works with modern family life. Life today is filled with useful devices and the newest, coolest gadgets, cell phones and laptops, game players and handheld GPS, you name it. Screens are everywhere. Life today is also all about access and information and media. We carry the World Wide Web around in our pockets and have turned the word Google into an everyday and well-used, maybe even overused, verb. Kids these days wondered how families are managing this brave new techno-heavy world where caregivers and kids alike are becoming increasingly comfortable with and reliant upon digital technology. So today, Anne Collier joins us. Anne is the editor, founder, and a blogger at netfamilynews.org. That's a site for parents that helps them understand the technology kids are using these days. We'll also check in at Anchorage's Aurora Waldorf School, where there's a deliberate absence of computers, media, and technology for school-aged kids. One mom pokes fun at her family, all of whom she says are techno addicts. And later in the program, we'll get advice about kid-friendly apps, what's available for smartphones and tablet computers right now. That's Kids These Days today on this listener-supported station. This is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy. This is your program, so get involved. Email your comments to mail@kidsthesedays.org or call us now, 1-888-KTD-RADIO. That's 888-583-7234. Joining me today by phone is Anne Collier. Anne blogs at and is the editor and founder of netfamilynews.org, which she calls Kid Tech News for Parents. She's the co-director of ConnectSafely.org, a web-based interactive forum and information site for teens, parents, educators, and everybody interested in the impact of the social web on youth and vice versa. She co-authored MySpace Unraveled, A Parent's Guide to Teen Social Networking, and Anne served as co-chair of the Obama Administration's Online Safety and Technology Working Group and made recommendations recently to the president. She's also the mother of two sons, and we're speaking with her today all the way from Luxembourg, where she's currently attending the European Commission's Safer Internet Forum. Anne, thanks so much for being here today with me on Kids These Days.
It's great to be with you, Shanna.
Well, Anne, maybe you can start off by telling us a little bit about these organizations that you're a part of on the internet. It's netfamilynews.org and also connectsafely.org. What do those places on the internet do for families?
Well, Net Family News is 13 years old now, and it's basically a blog. I was blogging before there were blogs on the internet, and it's just, as you said in the intro, it's Kid Tech News for Parents. So I just cover just about everything that comes down the pipe that might be of interest. It's kind of a filter for busy parents about how kids use technology, how to keep them safe, kind of the latest tech news developments that relate to families, you know, games, mobile phones, you name it. And our other site, my other big project is ConnectSafely.org, which is a major resource for parents with just all kinds of information, like tips on safe social networking, safe mobile phone use, what to do about cyberbullying, video game, constructive use, you'd name it, how to keep your password safe and secure. It's a real resource site as well as a forum where parents can talk about all this.
And you said that you were blogging about some of these things before blogging was such a common term as it is now. So what made you have the idea and get started with blogging about the technology that kids are using in a way that parents and caretakers can interact with that and sort of learn about what their kids already know?
Well, gosh, when I started this in 1997, I just thought that parents were kind of the silent majority in the public discussion. I actually thought I was kind of behind the curve in all of this. And parents deserved to know more, and they needed to be informed so that they could be, you know, have a voice both in technology use in their own homes, in the community, and in the larger public discussion about kids' online safety. So it just seemed really important to kind of have a community newspaper for an interest community rather than a geographical community. And that was sort of the original concept. And I started doing a weekly email newsletter And well, actually, it started monthly, and that started right about when the Supreme Court struck down this Communications Decency Act. So I tried to explain what that meant to parents, that, you know, that free speech, the First Amendment would not allow us to, you know, block adult porn, legal adult content on the website. And so parents were going to have to figure out through the use of technology and family rules and policies how to protect their kids from content that was not great for, or inappropriate content for children. And then, you know, it just kind of went from there.
Mm-hmm.
So
those here you are.
Early days in the online safety discussion, but I thought that it was really, really kind of time to get going.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have quite a few members of our Kids These Days community who've commented or asked questions about rules, family rules, and also about safety and so forth. But before we get on to some of those questions, I've been reading and making myself more familiar with a Kaiser Family Foundation study that came out in the beginning of this year. It's about daily media use among children and teens and how it's gone up dramatically in the last 5 years. And I wanted to read for you some of the information that came out of this study that seems particularly interesting to me and that I think you might have some great responses to. But it says that today, 8 to 18-year-olds devote an average of 7 hours and 38 minutes to using entertainment media across a typical day. And that when you really look at what that is, so that's in excess of 7.5 hours, but somehow because they can media multitask, they can actually cram 10 hours and 45 minutes worth of media content into those 7.5 hours. These numbers are really kind of staggering. I mean, that's a full-time job.
Yeah, I know. And I think we need to kind of be careful about how we read that. I looked at that study very carefully and blogged about it. There are several things I could say about that report. Yes, the numbers are staggering, but kids aren't spending all that time stretched out. You know, you mentioned multitasking, Shanna, and these things are going on kind of all at once, and even that, you know, when we think about it that way, it's a little bit scary. But I was just reading the English coverage of a German university's report about kids and digital media, and one of the things that study looked at was how children use Facebook. And sometimes, you know, parents are afraid that children are addicted to Facebook. But what the study found is that even when kids were kind of, you know, had Facebook running in the background, sort of like, you know, wallpaper in your room, it's just on, and they might hear a little ping and they might get engaged in a little conversation for a moment, and then they move on to something else, whether it's listening to music or doing homework or, mm-hmm. you know, watching TV on a weekend or playing video games. It's just kind of running in the background. But what the study also found, that their, you know, top interests were basketball, or, you know, it was a sport, or it was something offline that really mattered to them in their life, but they also had friends, they also had their social life, they also had Facebook running in the background. So it's not like technology is replacing their other interests, it's just that they have all these tools that they use, and sometimes they use them simultaneously, you know, and that's where rules come in. But it's not the way we think of media. And that was one of my criticisms of the Kaiser study. And, you know, there was all this horror in the news media and everything about all this time kids spend in media and with tech. But, you know, they were also looking at television. They were also looking at offline media and traditional media. But throughout the study were these words consume and consumption and consumer. And children are not consumers of media. When you consume media, that's a whole different story. And it can't be done in parallel. And it's a different kind of approach to media. They were really looking at, I believe, what the study was doing was kind of looking at children's use of digital media through a mass media, traditional media filter.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't do that. We can't look at the way our children use media and digital technology in, you know, through our old eyes. We can't sort of look at it from the perspective of traditional media consumption. So I think that's really important. We also don't, we need to be a little bit open-minded about how they use media, and we can't be automatically or reflexively critical. Mm-hmm. It's not just entertainment, and that was another criticism I had, that a lot of the way adults look at the way children use media is that it's a waste of time, or it's time away from what's important in their life or from their schoolwork. And it just isn't working that way. That's not what the social media research is finding.
Right. Well, maybe bridge that gap a little bit for us. So if a traditional way of looking at a consumer is something that adults who aren't integrated with media are looking at, that's the lens through which they're looking at and studying, help us all understand a little bit about how that young person who is integrated with media in their lives looks at it differently.
Well, it's not monolithic. It's not like, you know, sitting on the couch and watching a football game or watching a sitcom passively. They are engaged with media. Some people call them users. They're really participants, and in very often they're producers of media. There's a lot of creative work going on when they're in media. Now, I'm not just talking about texting or just social networking, but there's actually a lot of interesting things going on in social networking. Facebook isn't sort of a monolithic thing that a kid can be addicted to. What Facebook represents is their peer groups, their friends in real life. Facebook is very grounded in their real life social experience, and usually that's school life, right? So if they're addicted to anything, they're addicted to socializing, to interaction. And that's what the phone represents. I think Nielsen found that the average teenager texts something like 3,000 text messages a month now.
Wow.
And, you know, if you just look at that at face value, that too is a little bit staggering. But a text message isn't a phone conversation. A text message is a tiny part of a conversation. So it might be a dozen or 20 text messages that add up to, you know, a 20-minute conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we would, when we were teenagers, we would spend hours on the phone in one conversation. So,
you're saying this is sort of an extension.
Way of looking at,
yeah,
at telephone use, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So it's sort of an extension of what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong in this paraphrasing, is that the social networking media options and also texting and other ways that kids talk to one another these days is just an extension of that existing capacity for kids to sort of try to be social at a great degree when they're in their teen years and tween years?
Yeah, it's social, but there are other things going on. Facebook isn't a monolithic thing. It isn't just social. It isn't just status updates. It's not a monolithic thing. There are a lot of different little utilities in Facebook, as well as apps and games. And, you know, a lot of parents actually use Facebook, so they know this, that it's not, you know, sort of a single thing called social networking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to remind listeners that this is Kids These Days on this listener-supported station. Today we're talking about family life and the way we're using modern technology. Call us and join the conversation. That's 1-888-583-7234 or email us at mail@kidsthesedays.org. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and our guest today is Ann Collier. And Ann, you mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, you referenced this idea of rules, like rules within the home, within the family, that govern the way that each of its members, adults and youth included, interact with different kinds of digital technologies. And we've got a couple of comments that I collected from some people in our community describing some of the ways that they apply this idea of rules in their household. And I'd like to play one and then the other here for you now.
My name is Amy Carter, and with my children's Facebooks and MySpace, I have made sure they had to be my friend if they want to have this public forum, and I also have their passwords to all their accounts, including emails, so I can keep track of them. And the kids actually don't have a problem with it.
My name is Carla Tweet. The biggest problem in our family would be the texting. We did have a problem about 2 years ago. in regard to a young boy texting inappropriate comments, sexually suggestive things to my daughter. Thankfully, my daughter had listened to me in the past in regard to, you know, telling me when there's a problem, and she showed me the text. We were able to contact that gentleman's family and correct the behavior. However, that anything in the future that she doesn't see is appropriate, being that she's 15 and doesn't bring to my attention, I won't know about. So right now, the only thing that we can do as a family is when she's blatantly in trouble, we remove the phone from her, period, so she doesn't have her cellular device at all. And then when she can prove her behavior and trustworthiness, then she gets it back.
Well, and I just was wondering what your response to the ideas that these ladies have for how they manage their households, and if you have any kind of advice for parents for what can be done and what are good house rules for technology.
Oh, that's a big question. Well, first of all, I think they sound like very smart parents, and family policy and rules about technology is highly individual. It has to, you know, be based on your own family's values, right? And how, you know, your own parenting style. So, all, you know, that I totally support what those two parents arrived at. As far as, there's some really interesting data just out this week from Trustee, which sponsored a study of 2,000 parents and parents actually of teen social networkers nationwide. And they found that 80% of U.S. parents of teens who have social networking accounts have social networking accounts themselves, 80%, and 95% of them have Facebook accounts, 95% of the 80%, right? Mm-hmm. So those are very high figures. I was very interested in that. And the vast majority of the parents who do have Facebook accounts are friends with their teens in Facebook. 30% of those parents were asked by their teens to friend them. And, you know, I have a theory. The researchers didn't, you know, ask the question why their teens asked them to friend them in Facebook. But my theory is that it's because they wanted to get their parents past the fear factor. You know, we sort of fear what we don't understand. And I think those were probably mostly very smart teens who said, "Mom, Dad, friend me, and you'll see. It's just my, I'm just hanging out with my friends. I'm just talking with my friends, and they're good people, and I'm good people, so I think you'll find that it's okay, and check in on me every now and then." Mm-hmm. I think smart teens are doing that, and I think smart parents are friending their teens in Facebook so that they can check in. I hope that they're not writing on their walls a lot or commenting on posts and photos. That could be pretty embarrassing to a teen. So it's better to just kind of lurk and check in every now and then and use Facebook for your own purposes, which, you know, most mm-hmm. the vast majority of those parents do, I'm sure.
So maybe there's some etiquette around that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's very smart. And then the MySpace, the mobile phone policy, I think, you know, there are lots of rules that families can have about mobile phones, and it really depends on, you know, the age and trust levels of each of the kids in their house. You probably have different rules for kids of different ages, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most parents do. And, you know, how much can you trust your kid? How much, you know, is that kid... Like, is there a relationship where somebody might be texting way too much, maybe slightly abusive? There have been studies that show that some teen boys and girls are kind of stalking their quote-unquote romantic partners via text message, and that's when parents kind of have to intervene and limit usage. You know, other teens will, you know, want to be texting all night long or be available to their friends in the middle of the night and put their cell phone by their pillow and leave it on and lose a lot of sleep, and grades suffer. And so parents find that, hey, you know, you turn off your phone at night, and maybe, you know, if I can't totally trust you, the phone gets charged up in our bedroom, not your bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
So there are just different rules for different kids and in different situations. Sometimes kids have sleepovers or slumber parties, and things could get out of hand. You know, YouTube videos have shown up with, you know, girls jumping around in their underwear. Somebody took a video with a smartphone. It appears on YouTube. That is very not cool. That is inappropriate. And, you know, in some jurisdictions could be considered child pornography. So, you know, some families have a rule. Hey, everybody's cell phones are in this basket. And that basket stays in our room. No cell phones during the slumber party or the sleepover. Mm-hmm. So, it just really depends on the kids, the social group, and the trust levels.
And it sounds like you're saying it also depends on individual families. And it also seems like parents and caretakers also have to be thinking about how to make sure that they're doing their best to have their kids be using the technology in an appropriate way, too, and be sort of forward-thinking in that way.
Absolutely. I think the number one online safety tip, whether we're talking about fixed or mobile online, right? Mm-hmm. Whether we're talking about cell phones or the internet on computers or any other device, Xbox Live, you name it. If they're connected, the number one safety tip is talk with your kid. We really need to work from the kid out. Don't extrapolate from what those news headlines say about how kids use media, because you can't generalize. It's so individual how kids use media and technology and, you know, what's right in our family, your family.
Mm-hmm. And that idea, talk with your kid, I recently found through PBS.org, through that website, a one sheet that you can print off that's called Talk Tips for a Digital Media and Kids, for Digital Media and Kids. And, there are some pretty simple, like five different general questions. How will this be used? Another question, what are you doing? Another question, I don't like that. I do like that. Encouraging you as an adult to say, this is great about this technology, or this isn't so great about this particular technology. Another is this idea of house rules. And the last one is this idea of saying to the young person, show me how to use this, and engaging in that way.
Oh, I love that. Those are really great ideas. And that's all parents need, I think, is just sort of some starter talking points. But, yeah, it's the same kind of questions that we've always asked them, right? This is about parenting, not about technology. So how many friends are there on your friends list? Do you know all those people?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, do I know those people? It really depends on how much the parent wants to know what's going on. And, you know, it really is kind of empowering and supportive of mutual respect to sit down with the kid and see how they've set the privacy controls. You know, talk to them about that. And if they haven't thought about it much, then maybe go through the privacy settings together and see what's going on. Maybe learn a little bit about it together and think it through kind of out loud.
I love that idea. It's about parenting. It's not about technology.
Yeah, it really is.
And going back to what you said about, you know, families and circumstances being individual, and also that rules might be different depending upon the age of the child, I'd like to share this with you and our listeners. Even the littlest kids have an affinity for the high tech, and one local writer and a mother of a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old marvels at her kids' astounding intuition for how to turn on and navigate almost any digital device. So here is an original essay from Leslie Shu Oh about raising what she calls her techno addicts.
I drove home slower than usual. An enormous box weighed down my passenger seat. In the back, our 5-year-old daughter and 2-year-old son chanted, "Computer, computer, computer." I was nervous and relieved about bringing it home. My husband and I were tired of putting our kids in timeout for spilling liquids on our laptops, or even sneakier, hiding in the bathroom, claiming that they were peeing when they were actually reorganizing the apps on our iPhones. On the weekends, Kira would tiptoe out of bed while we were sleeping and browse the internet. One morning, we laid awake in bed listening to the giggles of our two troublemakers manipulating our complicated home theater system. We heard them start their Thomas the Train DVD, then switch to Sesame Street recorded with our DVR, and finally, when they were bored with all that, play their favorite Wii Lightning McQueen game. Ethan started to kick my seat, and Kira asked, "Mama, mama, can I have phone?" They both started to sing, "Mommy, mommy, 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 mommy." For a few moments apiece, I almost did hand over my iPhone. Lots of parents surrender their phones to their kids to calm them down. Some argue that the iPhone is educational. Many children, including my own, learn their first word from apps like Peekaboo Barn. Others warn that these gadgets limit a child's interaction with the world. Last week, my husband came home from an ice cream date with my kids and said, "Can you believe Ethan updated my Facebook status with my BlackBerry?" He showed me his Facebook wall, where 7 precise posts were made. The final post was a letter R, followed by a space, then the letter U. "Wow," I said, trying to make my husband feel better. "Our 2-year-old has figured out text messaging lingo. Not bad." My husband said, "So embarrassing." So what if several hundred friends receive those messages? At least it's not as bad as what Kira did last summer. Barely 4 years old, she had found my iPhone charging on my desk, and in a few minutes managed to break my passcode security and send 100 text messages. And that's not as bad as other stories we've seen or heard from our friends. A brand new HD camcorder dunked in the toilet. Or worrying about getting fired when your kid sent a company-wide email. Was this all our fault? I'll admit it, my husband and I are techno addicts. We are always on, it seems, through instant messaging, mobile phones, social network sites, and our kids are just emulating our behavior. We might have even encouraged their use of technology, thinking that this was good training for their technical and media literacy. Pulling my Bluetooth headset out of my ear, I floored the gas pedal and hurried home. Frost had crystallized the plants along the side of the road, and the tires felt slick. This fall, Kira started kindergarten, and I knew that we needed to pay attention to the digital road that my kids would be cruising. I couldn't ignore anymore the reports that youth spend nearly twice as much time as their parents think they spend online. I had to get savvy about the dangers of my kids being always on and help them navigate it safely. Parking the car in the garage, Kira and Ethan's voices rose into a war cry. "Computer! Computer! Computer!" And strapping them from their car seats, I ushered them out onto our gravel driveway. "Mama, can I have my computer?" Kira asked. I zipped their jackets and tightened their hoods and responded, "Sweetie, can you hear the river running? Soon it will freeze over." "Mommy, phone," Ethan demanded. "Maybe after we walk to the river, okay?" Holding tightly to their little hands, we started running down the driveway, leaving their BFFs behind.
That's commentator Leslie Sue Oh. She's a mom and someone who's thinking pretty critically about her technology use, her family's technology use, and then her 2- and 5-year-old who seem already pretty integrated. Do you have any response to I guess she talked about many things, but to Leslie's piece, Ann Collier?
Oh my gosh, she's amazing. First of all, she's an amazing writer, but I love that critical thinking. That's really key. I mean, what she was talking about, how they mimic us, they really do. So we need to think critically about our own technology use and how we're using it in front of them. Are we texting at dinner time, or are we focused on those around us? I hope we're not texting while driving. I remember listening to this amazing podcast between Annie Fox, an educator and author in Northern California, and Rosalind Weissman, the famous author of Queen Bees and Wannabes, who was also a consultant to the movie makers of Mean Girls. And Rosalind was saying she had a teen advisory group helping her write a new chapter about technology for an updated edition of Queen Bees and Wannabes. And one of her teen advisors was being texted by her mom while they were in a group discussion with Rosalind, and the mom was driving. She texted her daughter, "I'm driving your grandmother to the airport." And the daughter texted the mom back and said, "Mom, don't text while driving." And the mother texted her back and said, "Oh, be quiet." Now, what is that? What kind of message is she sending her daughter? And who was being the responsible one in that conversation? So I think Leslie's very, very smart to be thinking about that now when they're little. And of course, those are extremely tech-literate little ones. They may be just a little bit unusual, but wow, you know. And she's really talking about two different things, you know. Dumping the HD camera in the toilet is one problem that we have to deal with, like mashed potatoes in the VCR it used to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now it's also, you know, what they're doing with the devices put in their hands. Mm-hmm. And that's something we need that's when we talk about digital citizenship. That's when we talk about being kind to others and thinking about who's at the other end of that social media or social technology device that they're picking up. So, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, there are so many responses that I could have to that great essay.
Well, it's interesting. I wonder how unique her kids are. I'm sure her kids are very unique, but I mean to say about the technology and the interaction with technology. There is a recent New York Times article that's titled Toddler's Favorite Toy, the iPhone. And I know as the parent of toddlers, I've seen how easily my kids can pick up an iPhone and navigate it and do all sorts of things that I don't expect them to be able to do. And in that article that the New York Times recently printed, there's, you know, all sorts of conversation in there about how parents are also, you know, trying to sort this out. Like, is it always appropriate to give your kid your iPhone in the grocery store just simply so that you can shop without interruptions? I mean, sometimes that's a great thing. And when does it become a habit and so forth? And that same article prompted an email question from one of our Kids These Days listeners. Julia Seymour wrote in from Eagle River, and she says this. This question is about kids and technology in general. Given a recent article, the one I just dated, the New York Times, about the iPhone's rising popularity with toddlers, what are some ways to structure the use of smartphones and computers with very young children? And how young is too young?
I think it depends on the child, and I think it also depends on the parent, and how you feel is too young. I think, you know, inherent in that question is the question of whether or not we're using technology or devices as babysitters. And I think every parent has that feeling in his or her gut that, oh, I may be depending a little bit too much on, you know, this technology entertaining my child, and maybe I should be interacting a little more or a little less busy. And, you know, those are little warning signals that go off in our heads that, you know, sometimes we need to listen to. Sometimes we need to take away the media or shut down the DVD or on the laptop and, you know, do something else, do some non-screen time activity. So it's really up to each parent, but balance is still a good thing. It always was, and it is. Now it's a balanced media diet, and it's a balanced activity diet, you know?
Mm-hmm. Great advice from Ann Collier today on Kids These Days, where the conversation is about the intersection of family life and the digital age. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Coming up, we'll talk more with Ann. She's the founder, editor, and a blogger at netfamilynews.org. And also on the program later, we'll get the lowdown on smartphone apps for kids. All that after a short break. We'll be back in a minute.
Calculators and fax machines, electric grinders for your coffee beans, CD players you don't plug in, instant banking if you know your PIN, cable channels and satellites, all encoded with bits and bytes. Handheld games are fun for kids, electric openers to flip your lids.
The internet, the best thing yet,
a million places for you to go.
The internet, surf the net,
a million ways that you can spend your dough.
The internet, let's not forget,
the latest graphics to knock off your socks.
The internet, it's your best bet.
It's like a library in a box.
There's been a lot of talk recently about bullying and the tragic results that can come from it. Hi, I'm Shanna Sheehy, and next time on Kids These Days, we're taking a look at what bullying looks like in our community. What's your experience? Is your child hassled? Is your child an aggressor? How can caretakers help when kids are being harassed? How much do you know about cyberbullying? Let us know what you want to hear. Let us know what you want to hear about next time by calling 1-888-KTD-RADIO. That's 888-583-7234 now. email ideas anytime, mail@kidsthesedays.org. We'll find out how bullying is handled from grade school through graduation, and we'll talk about the link between bullying and the home. And Kids These Days heads out to one local high school to learn about efforts going on there to combat unkind behavior. That's next time on Kids These Days on KSKA, Tuesdays at 2 and again at 7. You're listening to Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and today we're talking about the intersection of family life with the digital age and all of the devices that we have to go along with that. We're talking to Ann Collier today. But first, many of us struggle with how much access to let our kids have to television, computers, Nintendo DSs, and other technology. Digital devices are so pervasive that opting out of the whole scene may not seem possible. But one Anchorage school says it is, at least as far as young children are concerned. The Aurora Waldorf School encourages families to be media-free and to put off letting kids use computers for as long as possible. Jessica Cochran has this profile.
In Lori Miller's 8th grade classroom, students start the day with singing and recitation.
And if one of our instruments breaks, it doesn't matter.
They soon move on to a physics lesson, which begins with a story.
So, the king was wondering, how can I find out if it's 100% gold? So he went to Archimedes. And Archimedes thought about it, and he thought he had some ideas, but it wasn't until he took a bath. He took a bath, and he stepped into the bath, and he said, aha! I know how to test.
Miller teaches at Aurora Waldorf School, a private school in Anchorage. Her classroom is its own little cabin, a small space with two rows of desks, a window seat reading nook, and a blackboard framed in rustic logs. Students review their notes from the previous day's experiments to try to figure out how to solve today's question.
Based on yesterday's experiments, and based on today's experiments and our review this morning, you'll be able to, I'll give you a clue that you're on the right track here.
Noticeably missing? Any sign of a computer. There isn't a Waldorf High School in Alaska. But another teacher, Peggy Finnegan, says if there were, that's when the students would begin working with computers.
And we value technology. We just evaluate it at a developmentally appropriate time. And in Waldorf schools, that generally in the curriculum comes in high school. And they learn first, a lot of times, what is a computer? They learn to build a computer. They learn what a computer is. They become the master of the tool rather than the slave to the tool, because the capacities for critical thinking and judgment, those all the foundations since early childhood and the grades, the flowering, the thinking really develops in the high school level. And that's when you can really dig in and use it.
That capacity for judgment is important, Finnegan says, because not everything on the internet is true or worthy of attention, and some of it isn't safe.
You know, I have really sharp knives that I cook with, but I would never give it to a 3-year-old because they're not ready to use that. I would let them develop the judgment, the muscle tone, all the skills that you need to really handle it well.
The Waldorf philosophy is based on teaching subjects when they are developmentally appropriate, building on what has been learned earlier. It includes practical skills, like building things from wood. Finnegan says that promotes self-confidence and problem-solving skills. Art, music, and movement are integrated into the classroom every day. The focus is on educating the whole person to their fullest capacity.
We look at the human being as like there's the whole thinking aspect, you know, critical reasoning, all these things. And there's the emotional component, the feeling life. What helps develop the feeling life so that they can make ethical choices. What's good? What's truth? What's beauty?
Finnegan worries many of today's kids may be missing out on that ethical element. With a constant bombardment of media images, she says they become desensitized. They also forget how to play and expect to be entertained. And she thinks a lot of computer learning programs play into that.
Most of the educational software out there is kind of edutainment. You do the right thing and you get a reward.
She believes many kids are pushed to learn skills before they're ready, mentally or physically. And she worries about the health aspects of computer time, from eye damage caused by radiant light from computer screens to the effects on the body of sitting for long periods of time.
We're kind of the oasis of healthy development, I feel, in the world.
That doesn't mean it's a complete oasis. Unlike some Waldorf schools, Aurora Waldorf does not have a policy requiring families to be media-free. The school does urge parents to make conscious choices.
Be conscious about what you're choosing and why. Know the reasons why you're having them, giving them computer time, and know the effects. And just be vigilant. Just be aware.
Many students do use computers, especially by the middle school grades. Finnegan says regardless of when they start using them, the Waldorf kids don't seem to have any problem figuring them out. I'm Jessica Cochran.
And I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm speaking with Ann Collier of netfamilynews.org and connectsafely.org. Ann, is it realistic? Is it healthy to restrict media from kids all the way through middle school?
There are a lot of values to respect there, but I do think that children can develop in healthy ways with or without media. I think it really depends on the teachers and the parents and, you know, how much children, that point about critical thinking is absolutely essential. One of the things that we talk about is that really for all children, let me just give you sort of a rundown of the youth risk research, that what we know as a society so far after a complete view of the risk research literature through 2008, that not all young people are equally at risk, that it's the kids who are most at risk offline who are most at risk online, that a child's psychosocial makeup and home and school environment are better predictors of risk than any technology a child uses. And that it's not about technology, it's the environment that a child grows up in. So is the parent modeling critical thinking? Is the parent engaged in that, him or herself? Are the children being taught balance? I do feel that media, social media, and digital technologies are here to stay, that they are a part of our lives now. And that, you know, even if children are, you know, sort of kept away from them in the early development years, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I do think that they need to be taught how to use technology responsibly from the moment it is put in their hands. And I have a feeling that it's very, very difficult to keep technology out of children's hands, even when they go to a school like Waterford. They will
right.
be exposed to technology otherwise. So, but what we recommend is that and we asked Congress in our 150-page report last June to make new media literacy and digital citizenship a national priority pre-K through 12 through the core curriculum. That's not teaching technology or teaching with it as a sort of an add-on to the core curriculum. It's just teaching children to be kind with one another online as well as offline from day one, and to teach them how to think critically not only about what they read, consume, download, and see in media, traditional or new media, but also about what they upload, share, and say online, because media are behavioral now. So we have to, it's a two-way kind of critical thinking. And that really needs to be taught in school, because digital citizenship is a verb. We can't be citizens without practicing citizenship. And we need to be using social media in school in safe ways, pre-K through 12, in order to be able to practice good citizenship online. And that's what makes us safe, because the risk literature says that kids who engage in aggressive behavior online are more than twice as likely to be victimized online. So it's like what goes around comes around. If children are taught to be civil and kind and ethical online, they will have good experiences online.
And just to clarify, when you say we, the recommendations that you're talking about, that's with the Online Safety and Technology Working Group that you were a co-chair of?
Right.
Okay.
That's what we recommended to Congress, and we hope that both the U.S. Department of Education as well as the FCC and FTC and the Department of Justice participated in the Online Safety and Technology Working Group. So we hope that these recommendations get pushed out into society so that, you know, teachers are less afraid to get involved in technology, and that we stop blocking it so much, stop fearing it so much, and engage in it with our children and help them think critically about it.
And I've mentioned before, and I'll say it again, that we will be linking to Ann Collier's netfamilynews.org and also connectsafely.org from our website. And are there other places where parents and caretakers and even kids themselves can get information about how to be a digital citizen and how to stay safe and be a good steward of that responsibility online?
You know, Shanna, I don't think they have to go somewhere to learn how to do that. I think we all have an idea, a very strong idea of how to be good citizens, how to treat one another. And it just needs to be transferred into cyberspace, too. Mm-hmm. This, you know, I keep saying it, but it's about our humanity, not our technology. It's about how we treat each other. And it's no different online. Even if you can't see who's on the other side of that status update or behind that avatar or at the other end of that text message, they're all human beings, just like us. And if we teach our children that, then they will treat those people at the other end of the text messages like fellow human beings with feelings.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Kids These Days, and this is a community-generated and driven conversation. And so, Anne, I collected a couple of questions. In fact, a high school class at Service High School here in Anchorage called in a few questions for you. And these relate to safety. So we'll hear them now and then have your response afterwards.
Hey, I'm Griffin. I'm calling from Service High School, and I'm wondering how you plan to keep kids from looking at internet pornography.
Kids should not be putting any kind of information on the internet. Their ASL, you know, where anybody can find it, because it's very dangerous in our community.
My name is Leandra Joseph, and my comment is that geotagging in photos is very dangerous. Anyone who views your photo can know your location, longitude, latitude, everything, and where you're at. So it's very dangerous.
So these high school students, and I'll repeat some of this information in case it was difficult to hear, but the first young man asked about, you know, how do parents expect to keep kids from looking at pornography? The next kid talked about the dangers of putting on too much information on the internet, and she referenced something called ASL, and I was hoping you might be able to help me figure out what that means. And then the last is this idea of giving geographical information, like specific GPS location type data about yourself online so that people can easily find you?
Well, those are great questions. There is no 100% guarantee of a risk-free internet experience. Let me just say that right up front. As for adult content, there are technology tools that parents can use to, you know, they work probably better for younger kids. Older kids can find workarounds, but there are filtering and blocking software programs that parents can download or install on their computers, their children's computers, hopefully. That's not a 100% guarantee because, you know, some families don't have blocking software, and so, you know, some kids can go to friends' houses and find other workarounds if they're really determined. But we don't use blocking software in our family, and we haven't had a problem so far. I think sometimes there might be a very sexually curious kid, and I think interest in sexual development is normative, and kids are interested in their developing bodies, and they do search the internet for information, you know, sex education type information, we know. So there is no, you know, guarantee that we can keep them away from adult content, but there certainly are tech aids for parents who are really concerned about that, or who have kids who are, you know, willfully or, you know, intentionally going out and looking for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Anne Collier, I think we have time for one last contribution from a Kids These Days listener. This call came in from Anchorage.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Johnson, and I'm calling from the Anchorage School District. I'd like your listeners to know about a video competition we're starting. It's called ASD Voices. And our topic for this first year is Internet safety. I am safe, I am secure, and I am ethical. The competition's open to students in the Anchorage School District, and they can submit a project they've created themselves, or they can do one with other students. There's no limit to the number who can enter. The final projects aren't due until December 17th, and the deadline for registration has been extended to November 1st. But that's just around the corner, so if anybody's interested, you'll need to look into it right away. It's open to students of all grade levels, and the winning videos will be made available for other students and staff to use when they're learning about Internet safety. So, if you're with the Anchorage School District and you're interested, please check with your teachers and ask them to look for the information on the ASDTube homepage. Thanks.
And we'll link to the Anchorage School District as well from kidsthesedays.org. Well, thank you so much, Ann Collier, for your time today and for joining us 10 hours ahead all the way from Luxembourg, where you're attending the Safer Internet Forum there. It's been great to have you on the program.
It was my pleasure, Shanna.
And from Kids These Days, we will link to Ann Collier's online resources for parents from our website at kidsthesedays.org. That's netfamilynews.org and connectsafely.org as well.
I'm down, I'm in the net connection. I'm down, I'm down, I'm in the net connection. I'm down, I'm in the net connection.
Last year, there were more than 7 billion mobile phone applications downloaded. This year, that number is expected to reach 10 billion. And some predict by 2012, there'll be almost 50 billion apps downloaded worldwide. We wondered what this app explosion means for kids and families, especially given the allure of smartphones and tablet computers for the youngest of us. KTD contributor Paul Flav asked tech writer John Herman his opinion on the matter. Herman is a New York City freelancer and contributing editor to both Gizmodo.com and SmartPlanet.com.
John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to what you've compiled for us, I was wondering what were the elements that made up a good educational app?
Well, it's tough because, everyone's going to be looking for a different thing. I suspect that a lot of parents will want something to just kind of keep children busy and to keep them entertained, while others will want to focus more on teaching tools. In all cases, I just tried to find things that kind of pass the basic test that they are professionally put together, that they have a winning concept, that they're executed well, and that from many accounts online, lots of children like. Some of the most interesting apps I've seen, particularly for young children, come from DuckDuckMoose. Wheels on the Bus builds on the, universal and some might say universally reviled song, if it's repeated too much, Wheels on the Bus, and, turns it into kind of an interactive, it's extremely simple, but seems to keep children occupied for a very long time, sort of like the song. Itsy Bitsy Spider carries children through sort of a loose, simple story, the purpose of which is to really present them with all kinds of interesting interactive scenes. So, along with the spider, you've got lots of characters, and when you touch them, they interact with the child. Moving on to the simpler concept games, you have one particular app for the iPhone and iPad called Animal Fun, which is a basic animal matching game. You see a picture, you match it with a sound, you match it with a name. To bring an older familiar character into a similar role, there's a Curious George branded word matching app, which is essentially a tool to teach children new words, but it's built around Curious George. So it's familiar and funny and I think probably more welcoming to a child than just a flashcard with a word followed by a definition. On a phone, that kind of thing can become really dynamic and interesting just because it moves, it makes sounds, and it's interactive in the most basic way. You're not pressing buttons or moving a mouse. You're actually touching these characters that you know from books or television. Some of the best, the most effective apps, at least for keeping children entertained, are musical apps. So the most obvious starting point there, I think, is piano apps on both Android and the iPhone and iPad. A simple search in either store will find you a multitude of free and paid piano apps that range from basic kind of sound toys to apps that will actually provide some instruction about how to read music and you know, how to play the piano. One of my personal favorites is called Smule's, that's S-M-U-L-E, Magic Piano. And it's kind of a wacky take on a typical piano app. So you have keyboards that take different shapes, that make different sounds. It's visually, you know, very interesting, and it's a lot of fun to use, whether you know, you can read music and you've played the piano before, or you just kind of, you know, are interacting with music for the first time in your life. I think it's one of those rare apps that has universal appeal, but it's particularly interesting to children.
In your research, have you come across ones that you just enjoy using?
One of my favorite educational apps, and it was actually featured recently in one of Apple's commercials because it's just such a neat idea, is StarWalk. What it essentially lets you do is use your device as a window to the stars. So you can, especially if you have a newer iPhone, you can actually hold it up to the sky and see a live representation of either what should be there if it's cloudy or if there's light pollution, or just an annotated display of what you're already seeing.
The iPad seems to be a product that would open up a lot of venues for developers. What has the iPad done for the educational app market and the app market in general?
Well, the some of the challenges of developing children's apps for the iPhone stem from the device just being kind of small. It won't really demand, it doesn't really demand someone's attention in the same way that the large panel of glass on an iPad does. And what that extra space and those extra pixels have done for developers is give them the ability to make apps that are closer to, you know, to things that children are already familiar with, like children's books. So you'll see a lot of artistic effort put into some of these apps on the iPad. They can display more than one thing at once, which, you know, makes educational apps a lot easier to make. One popular app is called My Very First App. It's based on Eric Carle's My Very First Books series, which, you know, they teach very, very basic concepts: colors, item recognition, simple word games, simple matching games. Things will do something when you touch them. Things will make sounds. Things will move. Things will react. And that's a much more intimate relationship with your learning materials than I think you get from, you know, just a coloring book or a picture book.
Well, great. Well, I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much for having me, and good luck finding the apps.
Thanks a lot.
That was KTD's Paul Flav speaking with John Herman. That's it for Kids These Days this week. Thanks for listening. Next week, we'll be talking about South Central schools and bullying. What's going on at your school, with your kids, in your home? We want to know. Call us about it now and leave a message. 1-888-583-7234. That's 888-KTD-RADIO. Or email us, mail@kidsthesedays.org. Today's program was produced by Sarah Gonzalez, who's also the mastermind behind all the content at kidsthesedays.org. You can find this program there as well as an archive filled with all of our shows and related web extras. Register and join the discussion forums every day of the week. That's kidsthesedays.org. Regular contributor Jessica Cochran reported from Anchorage today. We also had help from reporter Paul Flav. Essayist Leslie Shu Oh shared her thoughts on today's program. If you liked Leslie's commentary, you can find more from her coming soon to kidsthesedays.org. She'll be blogging about modern-day parenting for us beginning next week. I am Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for being a part of the Kids These Days community, and we'll see you next week.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.